Good evening, everybody, and welcome to this evening's event on the role of public libraries in the 21st century. I'm Christian Jensen. I'm head of collections and curation here in the British Library, and we're really pleased to welcome you all and to be able to help Camden with facilitating this really important beginning of a very difficult but far-reaching discussion of how to deal with public libraries in the 21st century, of course, bearing in mind the financial situation which Camden and so many other, well, all other councils find themselves in, indeed as we do as a public institution, but also setting that in the context of what's happening in the 21st century. I want to say just a little bit about how this looks with a sort of long British library perspective. The British Library's roots reach back to the Enlightenment and has as its core of its foundation the view that it is through knowledge and through participation and through enjoyment of life that human beings become good, sharing citizens of a society they understand they belong to and that they understand they belong to jointly with others. A very clear formulation of the knowledge-based importance of libraries was given to us in 1836 by an Italian political refugee. He had left Italy with a death sentence on his head and sought refuge in this country and very rapidly made progress and ended up being the director of the British Museum and Library. Antonio Panizzi. He gave evidence to a parliamentary committee in 1836 wanting to transform the British Museum Library from what one might think of as a cozy aristocratic club into a tool for democracy and for economic improvement. He said, "I want a poor student to have the same means of fathoming the most intricate inquiry as the richest man in the kingdom, and I contend that the government is bound to give him the most liberal and unlimited assistance in this respect." And I feel there's a lot in that which we can still subscribe to, and a lot of that which still encapsulates, in very broad principles, what libraries are here to do. So I hope that we can jointly begin to frame this very difficult debate, and I'm really pleased that we have got three not only distinguished but also extremely experienced, knowledgeable, and wise participants in our panel, who I will introduce very briefly for you. Brian Ashley, the Director of Libraries, Arts Council England. Libraries has been a very strong feature of Brian's career, and he now leads the Libraries for Arts Council England, so the strategic lead for supporting and developing the libraries sector. Tony Durkin, OBE, Assistant Director, Digital Newcastle, Newcastle City Council. A long-standing friend of the British Library, I may add. A previous president of the region agency, assistant director for customers, culture and skills at Newcastle. So Tony has an enormous wealth of experience in the sector to combine with his new digital remit as well. And to the far left, Anne-Marie Naylor, MBE, director at Common Futures, which is a new venture working with public, private and third sectors to explore community ownership and management, including libraries. And Marie is also Associate Director with Locality, with special importance for community assets. The way we're going to structure the evening is each of the panelists being given just about 3 minutes, not more than 3 minutes, for an overall statement on the overall topic of the debate. And I have to be rather firm on this, so it is 3 minutes. There's a clock up there. After that, I will ask a number of questions which have already been submitted by members of the audience, and we'll ask the panelists to address that in order. And if we've got any time left over at the end, we will open the discussion to the floor, but I don't think there'll be time for more than one or two questions. So, Brian, could I ask you to begin with your 3 minutes?
Thank you, Christian. So my starting point is, in answer to the question, of course, there is a role for public libraries in the 21st century. And I start by saying that public libraries are trusted spaces, free to enter and open to all. In them, people can explore and share reading, information, knowledge and culture. And that's a statement that we put the Arts Council put in our publication, The Library of the Future, which we released a couple of years ago. And I'm using that to draw on today. Christine has placed the debate in the context of the past. I'm going to echo that a little bit because the role of libraries has evolved over time. I contend it hasn't necessarily changed from one to another, but there have been, if you like, new layers of functions, new layers of roles over time. So if you go back to classical times, libraries were places where the philosophers met, and they were surrounded by the works of great thinkers of the time in papyri around the shelves. Move forward to medieval times, and libraries were much more were kind of elite spaces, the place for scholars to work in their closed communities. In Victorian and Edwardian times, government and philanthropists worked together to open libraries up for people to improve themselves, I think was the feeling at the time, but for a much wider range of the population. And then since World War II, we've seen an explosion in the number of library buildings around the country and an extension of library roles around provision of information and a community relationship building up between the library and its local population. And then at the turn of the century, we've seen the arrival of the digital world, demanding new skills, new resources, new aptitudes. And we now see a growing desire for people to use those resources to share, to participate and to create. So I see libraries developing from places where people access and consume to somewhere where people are now looking to collaborate and create content. So they're becoming making spaces as well as consuming spaces, where the boundaries between physical and the virtual are breaking down, and where the kind of divide between those that have and don't have, perhaps the numbers are dwindling of those who don't have access because digital access is so freely available, but the depth of divide between those that do and don't have access is perhaps getting deeper. And so there is a continuing, enduring role for libraries to support those who want to lift themselves from where they are now to a different place, as well as to sustain and kind of affirm people where they are already. And I think those are enduring features of a library service that simply won't dwindle away in the 21st century. So regardless of the resource, regardless of the tools that libraries and librarians have at their disposal, I think the role remains as fundamental in enabling people to change their lives, hopefully for the better.
Thank you very much. Tony, may I hand over to you?
I should point out that my brief says 3 to 4 minutes.
that was not counting.
And our brief was, what is the role for public libraries in the 20th century? So I'm going to give a little bit of context, talk about some headline service offers and contributions, some killer facts, a bit of a vision with a local dimension, and some more facts and figures. The public and media debate about public libraries understandably focuses on library cuts, library service closures, and the likely impact of on the service of continuing austerity. But as part of that, and alongside it, there are also many who challenge, and they have done since pre-austerity days, why we maintain and try to protect a 19th century offer. I think the answer to this latter challenge lies in the fact that many of the issues that led to the first public library acts in the mid-19th century remain significant issues more than a century and a half later. Brian's touched on some of these. Equality of access to knowledge and information, the need to support improved traditional and now digital literacy skills, safe and neutral community space, impartial yet expert advice and support. Many of us, including many of those people who question the 19th century model, can now afford to buy books and pay for effective broadband. They and we have our own personal equipment and infrastructure and our own spaces to use them. But we're not the majority. It's just that we are the articulate ones and the decision makers, and we often find it difficult to put our feet in the shoes of those who do not have all those benefits. So I'd just like to share some highlight examples of what public libraries, even in this age of austerity, continue to deliver, support and facilitate. So let's take children. Children who use the library are twice as likely to become as above average readers. Children and young people learn from an early age that they can explore every medium in the library through books, DVDs, story times, music, art and computers. A record 840,000 children took part in the National Summer Reading Challenge in 2014. The community aspect of libraries is especially important for new parents and their children. Children can easily read 5 books per week once they develop that fluency of reading, or want to be read 5 books a read. But the most wealthy parents can't afford to buy that amount of material. The public library service is the universal source of free reading. In terms of literacy and learning, libraries inspire people. We offer creative learning and reading opportunities. We offer guided help to access resources. We build literacy. There's an aspect of work which we're doing at the moment which is called the Universal Reading Offer. It builds on public demand for a lively and engaging reading setting with reading groups. It challenges, it promotes, and it encourages people to read new material. And some statistics, just in terms of this context. There are more than 3,000 public libraries in England, though 10% less than we had at the start of austerity in 2011. There are 98 million visits to library websites. 60% of the UK population have a library card. 35% of the UK population visit libraries at least once a month. There are more than 43,000 free computer terminals with access to the internet, catalogues and educational resources. And the latest research shows a 12% increase in the number of visits to public library websites over the last 2 years, over 106 million visits in 2014. And lack of access to the internet can reduce exam results by one grade. Public libraries can provide that access to children who do not have it at home. And there's been a recent decision in the budget to upgrade the ICT infrastructure in public libraries. The library service has a physical presence in every part of the country and more than 8.5 million active borrowers. And there are free community space, otherwise rare, on the high street and the centre of the village. In the 20th century role for public libraries, I have a vision of public libraries as a network of community hubs located strategically across a local authority, a region and a country. They should be easily accessible. They should deliver joined up services, information and support, both from the council and from relevant partners. They should be responsive to the diverse needs of our communities and customised for their needs too. We're implementing this vision in my own authority, Newcastle upon Tyne, and it might be clearer if I talked a little more parochially, because I think it's a transferable model. Like many other local authorities, Newcastle is having to reposition its core library network. It's doing so as community hubs. The rationalisation of the council's physical infrastructure has meant that elected members and officers have had to think long and hard about what sort of physical library presence the council would like and can afford. The community library hub will be the key council building in communities, strategically placed across the council's neighbourhoods. It will provide a base for a range of locally relevant services and will be the local focus for social inclusion activities. The library offer itself is being modernised, with a focus on its role as a catalyst for improved digital and traditional literacy skills across the city. And my service leads on digital inclusion for the city. All hubs will provide free access to superfast broadband and Wi-Fi. They will not be multifunctional spaces with a row of bookshelves. That's not a community library. The library ethos will be at the heart. The library hub will continue to offer safe and neutral community space, generous weekday and weekend opening hours, and that space will have to reflect the partnership's interests in that building as well. But we will still have the library ethos, the traditional library ethos of help, space, neutrality, excellent customer service, access to information, knowledge, and expert advice and mediation. Library hubs are ideally placed to support a council's digital agenda and change programme. They can and should provide a council's core and mediated digital inclusion network. Community library hubs, as I've just very superficially described, are only part of the story if you're talking about the role of the public library in the 21st century. Properly articulated, planned and delivered, that vision could ensure a very positive future for the community library service. But that there are other roles to be explored, and Brian and Christian have commented on both, really. The public library as a venue, a showcase for information, literature and heritage, a vibrant learning centre, all often, though not exclusively, associated with the larger libraries and authorities and in the cities. But we can't escape closure and cuts, and it's always a difficult decision to close a library. I do believe, and it's not a popular view, that some libraries should be closed because they're not in the right place, because they no longer flourish, that they're not supported by their community. What I think we have to remember, though, is that the library authority needs to continue to provide a comprehensive and efficient service for its residents, and that's not always about the service which is in the building. I mentioned earlier that 10% had closed since 2011, with a peak closing in 2011-12 and 12-13. But just to round up, the library service serves as an important community centre resource for people with few other sources of support. Libraries offer a range of services to those who might otherwise feel excluded, powerless or at risk. Unlike a lot of other organisations, people trust their libraries and visit them regularly. So libraries are a way to signpost services that customers may need but not know about. The library workforce is second only to GPs as trusted sources of information. Many people on low incomes or mental health problems use the library as there's nowhere else to go. More people visit public libraries every year than attend football matches and the cinema combined. So the 21st century model, a traditional 19th century ethos and ambition, a powerful model, the community hub for all local authorities, nuanced for local circumstances. And we need to identify and demonstrate not why libraries must be protected, but what would be lost if they are not. How long in a library-less land would it be before we had to create a more expensive alternative? Thank you.
Thank you very much, Tony. And Marie, can I pass on to you for your 3 or 4 minutes?
I'll do 2 minutes to make up
for an
extensive response. So I think we've heard from both speakers so far that there are a whole range of explanations as to what the functional role of a public library is and has been over a period of time. And it is in that respect that I think it's one of the most fundamentally contested concepts in terms of public services I have ever encountered. And over a period of the last 4 or 5 years that I've been working in and around this agenda from a number of different angles, the danger, it seems to me, is that a library tries to become all things to all people. And that whilst they may well provide homes to people during the day because there isn't adequate provision for people who are homeless in some places, or they may help people with mental health requirements and support needs because there isn't a good enough service in those respects. I don't necessarily agree that we should try to say the answer to that question is library. I think we should be outraged that those services are missing and think about how we reinvent them in other respects. So I'm concerned that we're going to become overstretched looking at the 21st century library if we try to be all things to all people and potentially misunderstood in terms of core purpose of what a library is for and what it can do. The Public Libraries Act itself does not say that one size fits all. On the contrary, it does say we need to provide a comprehensive and efficient service. And even though many people will continue to advocate for national standards in terms of library service delivery, research we recently did with OPM for DEFRA made very clear that already the function role of a rural library is very different to that of an urban library, and that of a central larger library is again different to a smaller urban branch library. I think we need to be quite clear that the role differs depending on where the library is situated if we're talking about library buildings. And looking ahead, we need to think quite differently, I think, about how to diversify the online or digital library offer, dependent on who's on the receiving end and what we're trying to achieve with that. So my provocation, I suppose, is there one role for public libraries, or is there a core offer? And above that, we should try to proactively encourage 1,000 or 3,000 flowers, very diverse flowers, to bloom across the country, so that each and every library building and service offered is responsive to the needs and aspirations of the community of users it's serving. And I would venture to say, beyond the 3,000, why aren't we aspiring to grow and develop new kinds of library models rather than managing things down and decline because the rhetoric of austerity is there? How are we thinking of new ways to entice different types of libraries to emerge in the 21st century? My particular bugbear is that the core offer currently in discourse around public libraries concerns access to information, knowledge and know-how of all kinds. I think that's absolutely valid, but I think, like Brian kind of alluded to at the beginning, it should also be in this sort of 21st century read-write world about contributing knowledge and know-how. Your library should be a place where you go in to contribute what you know as library users and to share that with other people peer-to-peer and encourage education and to grow rather than diminish the book stock as funds go down, but grow the stock of knowledge and know-how that each library benefits from so that we have a flourishing knowledge commons. It was Michael Edson, the director of web strategy recently from the Smithsonian, who gave a wonderful talk in South London and talked about the way in which dark matter was discovered. And he said that 95% of the universe isn't perceptible to the human eye upon discovery of dark matter. And he said, interestingly, every minute that we sit here, the world of data and content on the internet and electronic data and content is growing exponentially. But actually, we're diminishing and reducing the amount of content in our memory institutions, our museums and in our libraries. So it seems to me there's a question, is less is more a proposition that can last for much longer if that's the way that we manage changes to the library service? Or should we be trying to create platforms that are for reading and writing, just like the internet is, in our library buildings and through our library services so that we can grow the knowledge commons? And the last point I wanted to make was that I think libraries have been a tremendous force for democratisation. And it seems to me the largest new content category attaching to which are significant funds that could be leveraged by library services left, right and centre is data. And privacy issues surrounding data and trust issues surrounding data should, for me, be one very significant future for libraries in terms of their role.
Okay. Thank you very much. I think we had three rather diverse approaches to the theme yet with some very things which very clearly binded together around what space mean now, what does physicality mean now, what differences there between consumption and creation, and many other themes. I now have a number of questions which have been prepared by members of the audience. The first one is really relates to space and picks up rather closely on some of the things you've been talking about, Anne-Marie. So I'll save you to last, because this might give others an opportunity also to comment on some of the things you've been saying. This is a question from Gillian Darley, who says, have public libraries given sufficient thought to offering other services within the building, which remain as libraries? With a dual function, we do, after all, get two for the price of one. For instance, should there be post offices and libraries as in Essex? Brian, do you want to go first on that?
Thank you, yes. Have public libraries given sufficient thought to offering other services within the buildings? I think if you look across the country, there's just a myriad of examples of where libraries have done precisely that. Often in response to local circumstances, local partnerships, local situations, and often local individual relationships between managers of particular services. It's often the result of that sort of thing. So we see many situations where libraries are co-located with health services, for example. So you have a library in the same building as GP surgery and community health services, and there's a natural synergy going on there. Other places where libraries are co-located with children's centres, and indeed even youth services. So again, a very easy crossover between those things. I come from Nottingham, and Nottinghamshire County libraries have many libraries where the registrar for births, marriages and deaths is situated within the library service. And others that, in the way that Tony was describing, place libraries almost like the front door for their council for all customer-facing services. So I think there are many, many examples to show how libraries are doing precisely that, and I go further in saying that I think it is one of the ways that libraries can secure their future role by being hospitable to these other functions, these other services in that are community-based. But the crucial factor in all of that, again, picking up on something that Tony said, is retaining the essential ethos of a library. This is not about creating a multifunction space with just a few shared books in the corner. There are essential features about libraries which make them stand out and make them particularly hospitable to other functions. So I warmly endorse the approach, whether it's post offices as in Essex or whether it's some of those other examples that I've given, and I think it is one of a number of ways in which libraries can secure their future as we go forward.
Thank you, Tony. Yes, I also thought that it was interesting to pick up specifically on your point about how this fits around preserving the core raison d'être of the library's its ethos. But I didn't want to guide your question, but I could think that it fitted very neatly into some of your considerations.
Yeah, and I don't think I would have an awful lot to add to Brian, actually. I think there are very many examples of this, and I think as new libraries are built, and there are still new libraries being built in small towns and villages, and as well as the big city libraries that we've seen being rebuilt, they tend not to be built as standalone libraries anymore. They tend to be partnership buildings. And the really important point is that we are not pressurised into saying that we can just have this little room at the back which will count as the local library. It's the library ethos, that customer service, that neutrality, that honest broker role that makes those libraries accessible for other services and the public, really. So it's an old-fashioned word. There's a strong ethical framework to public library services, and it's important that they're maintained, that we can offer that support and advice to people. And I think if that's at the centre and the library is thought of as a public service, then it works incredibly well. And we cannot afford the range of buildings that we used to have. And I am biased because I am a public librarian, but I think the library is the key, is a very good example of the linchpin to help with that rationalised building estate.
Sorry, Tony, is it worth just touching on the housing partnership you've got in Newcastle? Because I just think that's another interesting model that you've got.
Yeah, well, this is real austerity, this. some of you may know that we launched a consultation 2 years ago about library closures. We have, you know, we're a very small geographical city. The old public library standard was 95% should live within a mile of a public library. Well, we hit that in Newcastle, and 70% lived within a mile of two libraries, and 62% lived within a mile of three libraries. So there was a need for some rationalisation, and some libraries were proposed for closure, which ideally we would not have closed. Our local housing organisation has come in and supported two of those libraries, and the local college has come in to support another two. So they haven't closed, and they're what we call partnership-funded libraries. We staff and provide the stock. They pay all the other running costs and deliver their own service from that building as well. And that's been a very, very exciting development, really, across the city. So if you get the partnership right, I think it's a way of sustaining the future of the service.
Anne-Marie.
What do I think? So my background before libraries as a focus is very much on the community ownership of land and buildings, and so a fair bit of experience with the community library model and that kind of thing. I think there's a number of things to say. First is that there's a real feel from the austerity kind of discourse from central government around publicly owned assets, that it would be better, irrespective of thinking about specific services, to look for fewer, larger sites, and to combine services into hubs as well, intended or otherwise, as possible. For me, I think that libraries are first and foremost a service, albeit they are housed still largely within buildings at present, and there are some financial benefits or efficiencies to be gained from rationalising into fewer, larger sites. But there are also trade-offs about distances and impact upon accessibility that we need to think carefully about. And I think they're largely taken care of by very detailed needs analysis and consultations that local authorities up and down the country are conducting. But I think we need to think about the trade-off that we're really looking at when we do close actual buildings down or we put other services into them, because these are services which require space to flourish, and they will be impacted significantly if the design is ill-conceived, when we look at multi-hubs in particular. They are trusted, impartial, non-threatening and educational spaces, but if you put completely different services in, like how to get benefits advice and such like, you invite a very different feel to some of the clientele that might desperately need and rely upon library services who may be less inclined to use them. I think a certain amount of revenue can be generated through letting space to other services, but it's really important in the context of any forthcoming sort of discussion on the subject that you realise that when income is generated in a public asset, it goes into the council's general account. So it isn't ring-fenced for library service benefits. So it saves money overall, but it doesn't actually help save the library service or the library budget per se in all instances.
That's not always the case.
Not always, because you can have a model that will generate income
to keep that library open, and it's ring-fenced to
indeed.
That library.
So that's what I was going to say, which is I think what we need to do is say if we're going to look at enterprise models, we need to generate them in outside. So Manchester's got a really good model with a development trust that does just that, so that the revenue is there to actually bolster and improve the library service over time. I also think that having crunched the numbers on it, that the efficiencies are still quite limited. They've already been made in most places, in actual fact, and that you're now looking at direct cuts. And that actually using spaces for what I would prefer to see as complementary or evolutionary services around libraries, rather than trying to just co-locate lots of things to save money more and more in tight times, is the ideal kind of outcome. And using that opportunity to leverage income generation prospects on a social enterprise footing, so that that money can go back into reviving and evolving the library service.
May I ask, perhaps you, as a sort of supplementary question about how people react to spaces which have a complex offering? I think of myself as a fairly self-confident person, but if I go into a space without knowing what to do where, I sometimes decide, actually, I feel too stressed for this. I'd rather go and have a cup of tea. Is there something about creating a multitude of different activities which one needs to balance against easy understandability of functions and buildings?
I think there's a difference between the perception of what's in a space from the outside and the experience of being in the space and moving between spaces within it, and that can be well-designed or not. But if you perceive something as a library and you regard yourself as a potential library user, then that's fine. But if it feels like it's a different kind of space and it's not for you, or there's something in there that you find is off-putting, I think that's where the challenge is. And I think conveying that message is really, really important.
But I think as well, you can think of these kind of hub opportunities where there are these multi-functions going on, actually going into a space which is comfortable like a library can actually enable you to orientate yourself within that space. I'm not completely disagreeing, but I just think there are benefits there as well as disadvantages.
Thank you very much. The next question is really about libraries in the digital world. That comes from Carol Stewart, who says, given in the digital explosion recent years, what role should there be for libraries in the future, and what standards should public libraries measure themselves against to see whether they are successful in meeting digital needs or not? Tony, could I ask you to go first on that?
One of the things that I think is really interesting is that until about 2003, public libraries used ICT as a way of providing access to information or enabling people to get access to information. And when the government brought in the People's Network, which was free access to ICT, the paper that brought that in made it clear that it was now a responsibility of public libraries to provide access to digital equipment per se, rather than just for accessing information. So that's quite fundamental. It wasn't put in large writing, but it was quite fundamental. And I think there are probably three aspects of digital which is the library's responsibility and role. One is about literacy, about digital literacy. it's not easy to say this really, but or to get people to take this up as a mantra, but if you talk about reading for pleasure, it builds a fluent reader. If you are excited by reading, encouraged to read, develop the reading habit, usually through reading for pleasure, you can read well and you can cope with the tax form much more easily. You can cope with the bureaucracy of modern life more easily. So I'd really like a mantra, digital for pleasure, but it's like sounds slightly seedy, so I can't get my council. I can't get my council to adopt it. But it's exactly the same. If you can introduce people to digital activity through things that they enjoy, they will build up a confidence, and then they will be able to deal with things that have to be done digitally, because there are lots of things there isn't a lot of choice about now. So I think digital literacy, as with traditional literacy, is a key part of the library's role. So there's access to digital equipment. To provide that equality, I made a comment about access to the internet can make a great difference. You know, it's not that long ago that the only place that many fifth form students, GCS students, could do the desktop finish on their GCSE project was if they had access to a public library and the printer and the PC that was there. And there are still lots of people that don't have that at home. So that, I think, is very important as well. I think there's a big issue about content, which I would agree with as well. And that's about how we in libraries make our content available digitally. A lot of really good work has been done, particularly in local studies libraries, where they have digitised records or worked in partnership with other groups to digitise records to make them more available and encourage community groups to contribute to that. So we have the infrastructure and we have the buildings to support that. And we have, you know, we've always created content, so we have to think about creating that in the digital format. And then I think there is the issue of digital service. So that's not about digital inclusion, it's not about government digital services. It's about what is the digital library service. If you are a person who likes to deal with things digitally and not use buildings, not go into department stores per order, why can't you operate your library service in the same way? Now, you can up to a certain degree, but it's not quite joined up. So I think there's a big issue about how we do that for the people who will want to use information services and library services but will not want to use a traditional model where you have to go into a building. You can reserve online, you can join online, you can probably extract information and put it on the cloud online. We haven't really sorted out an online delivery service in the public library service. If you want a book delivered, we're still negotiating our way through the whole e-books issue. Positive progress, but we're not there yet. So there is that truly digital library service nut which remains to be cracked.
Thank you. And Marie, do you want to go next on that?
Sure. So when I read this question, I was kind of concerned that there may be a view in some places that we don't need physical buildings and regular libraries and real books anymore, because certainly that's the view in some quarters that I've encountered, where people think that e-books and e-readers herald the death knell for the traditional public library.
Would you speak more loudly,
sure,
please?
Certainly. So I think it's particularly unhelpful when we consider people who are incredibly reliant upon library services for basic literacy, as Tony's talked about, going right through to digital confidence and digital skills development before we even talk about e-books and e-readers, to have a genuinely tangible library presence and service offer. Particularly concerned that libraries don't become too much about access to the internet as a solution to kind of the lack of affordable broadband provision in the country for deprived communities, and to question how library services could actually trailblaze in that regard. So if you look across at the US to Kansas and the Gigabit Library project, fantastic initiative, where former TV white space, when they went digital, is being used to broadcast Wi-Fi free around libraries to communities instead of it being offered by a private company in partnership with your local authority. Why couldn't we do that here? That's the end of rural notspots overnight. And why couldn't the library anchor it and charge a small amount to help sustain the library service? So there's things like that. The New York Public Library Service lends Wi-Fi hotspots. Is that something we should do? Should we lend digital equipment? Could we do what Florida are doing and loan drones Sounds exciting. I can imagine more guys and more young boys coming into libraries at weekends to manage robots, and that's certainly a project we're looking at with a couple of councils at the moment. So there's some really interesting ways in which I think we can get very exciting library services because of the digital revolution and really sort of commandeer that kind of area of activity going forward. I also think it's a way that you can generate an income because the Public Libraries Act was very helpfully conceived in 1964 and allows you not to charge for books and other facilities that are more traditional. But you could actually access new users with disposable income. And please do send me a delivery service so that I can order my book and pick it up at the train station because I can't make my branch opening hours, or I'll pay a premium for it to come home. And if not, Amazon are now delivering by drones in Washington. So there is a way forward for rural communities. So I do think there are solutions here. And I think it's actually a really exciting time because needs must when austerity is there. So actually, it's a great time of creativity. And I think digital holds out a really exciting prospect for libraries going forward.
May I ask a little supplement to that? You began by being very eloquent about the importance of physical space, and I think I very much agree about that. Public spaces is where we express ourselves also as being part of the same society, and that is really, I think, profoundly very important for us to be able to live together. How do you feel that those two sit, your drone vision of the world and your physical space vision of the world, do they meet?
So the main project that I preside over is called Common Libraries, and this is very much about putting tools and equipment into physical library spaces to enable content creation of different kinds. So you might go into your library and use digital equipment to record your latest music and promote your first single, right? Through the library, why not? It's content. You might go in there and edit a film that you want to make, or you might go in there and use a 3D printer and invent the next big thing. Not that I can talk about what that might be. So I think there's something about tools, digital tools in physical spaces that enable people to share learning, knowledge and know-how and create content together that makes quite a synergistic sense.
Great, thank you. Brian.
Thank you. And I won't go over the ground that Anne-Marie and Tony have covered around things like digital library services, the creation of content, and the development of skills. I think the two additional things I would want to add. One is that increasingly there is this phrase digital by default, that the public sector is being expected or choosing to provide more and more services that are only available digitally. And of course that only helps if people have full access to not only some IT, but actually IT that is sufficiently good quality and robustness to enable them to access those services. So in that world where we're currently around, I think, 18-20% of the population don't have that access for whatever reason, then however much that dwindles, it's not going to go down to zero. So libraries are the place where people can go to ensure they have equal access to services across the board, because if that weren't to happen, then we may see entire business models of the public sector falling over because they can't reach everybody. And then I think the other area I just want to touch on is that whole bit of just supporting people to navigate the digital world. I think it's something that we assume and we take for granted, particularly for as young people are growing, that the extraordinary abilities that people have from a very young age in using digital resources, but actually still can fall down on some fairly fundamental ways of accessing information and just understanding the difference between what's reliable or authoritative and what isn't. And that's, you know, at the heart of what the role of a librarian has been through the ages, is creating a sense of authority in the collection. And I think we need to encourage and enable that to continue with the added spice of drawing on the resource of the community, because there is expertise in the community that frankly no librarian will be able to hold it all in their heads or their capacity. So I think there's an enduring role for the librarian to be there at the heart of all of that, but drawing on the capacity and resource that's out there. I think we've all been very diligent at answering the first half of the question. The difficult second half of the question was about what standards should public libraries have to measure all of this. And I think we have to just accept that the current appetite across government is not to have library standards as such, however frustrating that might be for some people. But that doesn't mean to say that there aren't standards of good provision that aren't already being provided, and we're working nationally and locally with colleagues in government digital services. And I think it's through those, rather than having library-specific standards, it's about using industry standards that work and making sure that they work right for the libraries.
I was just going to make two comments, really. One an observation. I agreed entirely with what you were saying about navigation. And I've worked in libraries long enough to remember that when you got a new edition of the Encyclopaedia Britannica, you used to run user sessions on navigating that Encyclopaedia Britannica, especially if the sort of format had changed in the edition, because anybody could use it but wouldn't necessarily get the best out of it until someone had taken them through it, the three sequences and things like that. And that's rather the same with the Google. Helping people with some very simple search strategies, how you think about your search, can enable a customer to get a much better response when they search. And I think that role still remains very, very strongly. And the other thing I was just mulling over, as Brian said about the second part of the question, that if you had a truly digital library service, so your books were ready to collect as you got to the railway station, it would be interesting to see how much that active membership of the public library service might increase. Because I have three allegedly grown-up children. They never use a physical public library service. They do everything digitally. If my son could be sure that he would be able to pick up his books in Cockermouth, he would use the library service digitally. And I just wonder, that would be quite an interesting measure.
I've got two more questions and only 9 minutes left. But thank you for that. The next question is from Ken Ellis, and it picks up on some of the things that have been talked about here, which is reaching out to audiences which could become more engaged. He says students seasonally crowd at least one public library en masse and leave suddenly as they came until next time they turn up. I'm told, he says, the reason is exams. As these crowds seem to use the library for table and chairs and nothing more, should the opportunity be taken to persuade them to join the library or presumably to become more engaged with joining the library? Do you want to go first, Anne-Marie?
I'm going to be controversial and quick, so I'm going to say no. I'm going to say, what value persuading more people to join the library service? And I think you need to start from not thinking about numbers and bums on seats, which is all very nice, and they do crowd in during exam season and they disappear off for various reasons. I think you need to think about to what end, what's the purpose of increasing library usage. So I think Tony's statistic earlier was 35% of population regularly use a library. Thereabouts, it's about 15% actually in really affluent areas, or semi-affluent areas in fact. And it's about 50% every single week in a deprived area. So there's quite clearly a distinctive need for different types of users for services. I think we should think about what are the outcomes we want the library service to deliver. If it's literacy, target people that need literacy support and get those bums on seats.
May I reinterpret his question a bit? And I think perhaps actually he meant you have all these people who come in. Wouldn't it be an opportunity to show them what other things they could actually use the library for in a more meaningful way?
You could.
Okay.
You could interpret it that way. I didn't.
Fair enough. I can't push it any further. Tony.
I agree. I largely agree with that. I think what we also, that statistic of 30-odd percent is people who are what we call active users. They're people who've got tickets and they're people who borrow or use services with their tickets. That doesn't count at all the large number of people who never borrow but come in frequently to read the newspapers, as community space, etc., to read the books on the shelves. And that's one of the things about the public library service, that it's there for people at different times for different reasons. The students come in, largely, I think, because at their educational institutions, there's no desk space left at exam time, and perhaps because we're a bit friendlier. And it's a problem. It's not a problem. It's an issue right across the country, really, and it's quite a positive issue. It changes the nature of the library during the exam season. Some people get a bit irritated, but it gives a buoyancy. But if they don't want to use the library during the rest of the year. If they're not borrowers, then there is little point issuing tickets just to record that somebody's been in once. And it is terribly important that you can come in without having to have a ticket. I'm not arguing about trying to extend membership. I think that is very important, but it has to be for the right reasons. And there's something really democratic about the public library service, that you can come in and use many of those services without having to prove who you are and without having to have a ticket.
I won't add to that. I agree with the points that have been made. I'll just tell a story of a large library, not in London, that I visited latter part of last year, and there were three sofas, each of which could probably accommodate three people at a pinch, but more comfortably two. But across those three sofas, there were probably at least 15 young people draped in various positions. You would look from the distance and kind of question whether that was a proper right and purpose for using the library space. If you approach them more closely, as I did, you'd discover that actually they all had a copy of exactly the same book in their hands, and they were talking animatedly and passionately about that book. As part of their studies, yes, but the fervour in what they were saying was extraordinary and heartwarming. And so I think sometimes we can look from afar and question why people are there without necessarily going closer. So the library as a space, a trusted space, as I touched on earlier, where people can go without question, is one of its great qualities. And I think this is a problem we should all love to have. But it's a case of local management of space in a sensitive kind of way.
I'm very sympathetic to that, I have to say. I have one more question left, and we have 4 minutes to go. So could I perhaps ask you to be relatively brief? This is the tough situation of the public sector spending. The questioner is Anna Reagan. She says, in a world where resources are finite and overexploited for profits, what benefit is then closing systems such as libraries where resources are shared and valued by people? Would it not be more dynamic and beneficial to extend systems of collective use and benefits to such as libraries? Tony, do you want to go first on that?
I think I've perhaps commented on this already. I think there have been libraries, and it was right to close them because they weren't used, they weren't in the right place, they'd not got the right offer. I think where a library is in the right place, it has the right support from its community, it has the right offer, then it feels wrong to close it. I think you might have to look at a modernised way of delivering that offer in partnership with other organisations, demonstrating. You have to demonstrate why it is important to keep that library open if it's under threat. But I agree with the sentiments of that question, that if it's a good library, why should we be closing it when it offers such an important service?
Yes, I suppose it also picks up on your Amazon point. Do you want to go next on that?
Well, again, I agree with the sentiment behind the question, and I don't think there would be any desire on my point to see the implication of closing down the system of libraries. I think that goes against everything we've been saying this evening. The question is clearly we have to operate within the resource that's available to us. A part of the question behind here is questioning the entire globalisation setup, and of course that's something we could debate another time, perhaps in the pub afterwards, but it's something not necessarily within our gift to solve. So underlying all of that is, in a sense, is that the collective strength of a community as represented through services like libraries is something that we should treasure and sustain in this country.
Anne-Marie.
So I think there are three ways of looking at this. A lot of people have campaigned and said, we don't like the austerity, we don't like you closing our library in particular, and they campaign largely in more affluent areas with higher social capital than those areas that really desperately need libraries. And I think that the response in the public sector in many places, whilst valiant, has been to manage decline and say we need to manage within the budgets we're given. I don't agree. I don't think that is the only option open. I think that there is a middle way. There is a way to see a kind of reinvention of libraries and evolution of some library services run perhaps on a social enterprise footing in different ways, to put libraries in new types of spaces and encourage new public libraries to emerge in private spaces as well that are suddenly given different kinds of access. We've certainly been approached by lots of people that say we don't like public libraries, we like your idea of libraries, can we build one in our space? We'd let other people come and use it. So I do think there are new conversations to be had with unusual suspects. There is then the third alternative, which is the third way forward, which is the Buckminster Fuller offer that says if it's broken and more people are increasingly going to use internet-based or digital-based services, we should completely overhaul and reinvent the library. I don't happen to think that that is entirely the way forward, but I do think we need to look at this idea of how to modernise around content production, contribution and sharing. And the government helpfully put out a sharing economy report with full endorsement not many weeks ago. It didn't talk about any kind of intangible assets, knowledge assets, know-how. It talked about how to share physical things, physical infrastructure that's owned by our public bodies. I think it's imperative library leaders actually lobby governments to say there's a role here in the sharing economy that the library service can fulfil and take forward and trailblaze around.